Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. I'm your co-host Israel Munoz, joined with co-host Lynn Bairstow, and today we have the pleasure of welcoming on partners at Ego Death Capital, Andy and Nico. Welcome both. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you guys so much for having us. We can't wait to have the conversation with you.
Yeah, no, we really appreciate it. We did one episode already with your other partner, Jeff Booth, well-known in the space, and we had a great episode with him. But today we wanted to get a little more into the investment process at Ego Death, you know, maybe some of your thesis behind the fund and what startups can expect when approaching a Bitcoin-only venture capital fund. However, before we get into the into all of that context behind Ego Death Capital, it'd be great to start with a little more about both of you, Andy and Nico. You know, maybe how Ego Death was formed.
Yeah, I can jump in first. My name is Nico Lechuga. I'm one of the founding partners at Ego Death Capital with Andy and Jeff Booth, Andy Pitt and Jeff Booth. We formed the fund in 2022. Backing up a little bit, I guess, from personal background, I started my career off in private equity, predominantly looking at projects in emerging and frontier markets. This really gave me an idea of like broken money within the world, but I think not coming to the conclusion of Bitcoin as like part of a personal portfolio for a while, as this was like over a decade ago at the start. I left private equity. I own a company in a consumer packaged goods space. I own a hot sauce company. It started as a passion project. It took off in its own way. We've done collaborations with huge individuals, like a Joe Rogan, to publicly traded companies. But in, I would say, like the interesting part of like where we're at today, I met Jeff and Andy through a group, like this entrepreneur group, years ago, separately. So I met Jeff pretty late night. Jeff likes to stay out at some of these conferences, and Jeff doesn't sleep. He's amazing as an individual. And so we met late night, and he told me his theory on deflation, which we all know turned into the price of tomorrow, and that he was going to write all of this down and how it opposed kind of the inflationary system that we lived in. And we kind of hit it off from there, spent the next few days together. Andy and I actually met during COVID. There was a small group of like entrepreneurs that was put together, and we hit it off. And as we started to come into like Bitcoin and Bitcoin technology companies as an investment thesis, I put Andy and Jeff together to see if like they jived, and thought that there was something there. And that kind of the rest is history. We could dive into like the fund thesis and everything else, but that was kind of how the three of us came together.
Andy, and my background. Yeah, sure. So my background is in traditional finance. I worked with Goldman Sachs for around 7 years across investment banking in Australia, leveraged finance, and then I sat on the trading floor in New York for several years, where I was doing kind of principal, basically like large structured credit principal trades, which we would then fund in a variety of interesting ways, and then you get some really interesting credit funding arbitrage opportunities effectively. That was pretty global. Got to work in Brazil, looking really at deals all around the world. I was doing that, but always kind of I had a deep passion for emerging markets, for developing countries, that had come really since I was a teenager. And so that was kind of, ended up leaving Goldman, going down a more entrepreneurial path, which is how I met Nico. But it was really kind of this meeting point of finance and with my background investing and kind of that emerging market, global, like recognizing the whole system is broken and this has the potential to fix it. That was really interesting to me. And I think what sort of Bitcoin brings a lot of those different things together.
And you were introduced to Bitcoin how did that come about? I always love to hear people's origin stories in Bitcoin.
I mean, I first came across it in 2017, I was sitting on the trading floor at Goldman Sachs when Bitcoin was going through its really big price spike. At the time, I would say I didn't necessarily get it. It was like this crazy thing. I remember a guy on the trading floor, I think, just had made so much money off Bitcoin at that point. He quit and like bought a house in the Hamptons and like semi-retired. Good for him. And then I ended up leaving. When I left Goldman, I met a bunch of people who are more involved in the crypto world. But I think a lot of like Ethereum and a lot of the use cases they were talking about didn't really make sense to me. So I was like at Tech Open Air in Berlin in 2018, seeing the early days of kind of Polygon and Polkadot and all of these like L0, L1s, like, and I didn't really, I don't know, none of it really made a lot of sense. So I sort of put off the whole thing and I didn't quite get Bitcoin. And it really wasn't until probably really a few years later when I started to actually understand Bitcoin versus crypto and understand the macroeconomics and financial aspects of it, as opposed to sort of like the use cases, which people were talking about that didn't really make sense.
Nico, how about you? What was it about it that attracted you to it when you first were introduced?
Initially, if we were being completely honest, I guess funny, there's a component of, we had talked about like Trump's speech before this, but like the Silk Road was like my first introduction to Bitcoin. And the Silk Road like gets a lot of credit right now as this this marketplace, but there was another marketplace at the time period called the Armory. And if we think about, like, I was showing my wife the Bitcoin magazine, and it reminded me of like old school Vice and like the old school like Vice magazine that would like come out of Brooklyn. At that time period, they had written about the two different marketplaces. And it was so fascinating to me that one, you had this like drug marketplace. And on the other one, you had a marketplace where you could literally buy a tank and it would somehow get shipped to you with like parts. And you were using this like internet money with it. And I think that was like the fascination at that time period. And then I would just see it like pieces here, you buy a little bit there. But it didn't really click, I think, until we had the conversation with Jeff of like this broken system. And then it made sense to me from a portfolio construction standpoint. Much more than anything else in the altcoin ecosystem or anything else of, okay, if I'm going to have exposure to different assets, if I'm looking to maintain and like grow personal wealth, like this makes sense. But I would say that to me, like just based on who I am, is not interesting, right? That's like something that you just like allocate some money to on a daily basis or a monthly basis or whenever you're constructing your portfolio. What really like grabbed me was at the time period when Andy, Jeff, myself came together, was this realization of some key upgrades to the network that had happened and the ability for you to build in layers on top of that. And like what that was going to unlock from an investment standpoint, what it was going to lock from an entrepreneur standpoint. And to me, like that was where the interest was of, okay, we have this base asset that's immutable, that's decentralized, that's secure, that has a set amount to it. I understand that. That's amazing. What's going to be built on top of that are going to be your Googles, your Facebooks, the bleeding edge of like technology tomorrow. And I think like that got all of our blood kind of pumping, because we have a finite amount of time on this world and you get to use it doing things that you're passionate about, hopefully. And this something I think is something that we're all pretty passionate about.
No, I mean, thanks for sharing, Andy and Nico. And I mean, you answered it slightly there, Nico, but maybe, you know, maybe if we can get into it a little bit more. I mean, I was going to ask, so typically, you know, it takes a while to first understand Bitcoin. Of course, you both did, you know, in a short few years based on your stories. And then to go from that leap of, you know, I understand what Bitcoin is, to the actually building companies or investing in companies building on the protocol, that's a leap that's still a bit hard for many people to grasp, right? So from what I'm understanding, for you guys, it was this recognition that this protocol, this solid protocol exists, and now there's just going to be a plethora of different entrepreneurs and businesses that can kind of plug into and create some sort of application or interface on top of that? Or what was the point that got you convinced to actually go into the venture capital side of the Bitcoin ecosystem?
I mean, we had this conversation internally. So Jeff, Andy, myself looked at like hundreds of billions of dollars that had been invested, that had been raised to invest in this altcoin ecosystem. And we felt like that was like building on sand. And at that time period, I think there were like, call it $50 to $70 million of total venture capital money. Now, like Lightning Labs did a round pretty quickly afterwards, after we had, and so that raised the valuation as like Lightning Labs, I believe, raised like $70-something million. But what we saw was an asymmetric opportunity. And I think anytime that you're investing, you're like, you were pretty keyed in over the course of your life to find asymmetric investment opportunities. And so we saw this asymmetric investment opportunity that we felt like the broader world didn't understand. They had one, ignored Bitcoin for so long. So you had your traditional financiers that just in 2024 have decided that this is an asset that they need to allocate money to. But to even think that, like, the depth of knowledge of, okay, all of this noise that we have in the 2017 ICO world and 2021, call it like airdrop world, that is noise. And the signal are these real equity businesses that are going to be built on top of like Bitcoin in a layered approach is where we should be investing and allocating. And at that time period, what we really saw and Jeff honed in on was that there was no leading team. Like, I remember a very internal conversation that we had had at that time period. Leading team meaning like there are other great funds that invest in this space, but there wasn't somebody that was saying, okay, I'm going to invest just in seed stage companies. We're going to write $1 million checks into them and we're going to lead these rounds. And we've built a team with entrepreneurs and we're going to help you scale your companies. That was it. In the past, there wasn't enough in Bitcoin. So if you wanted to invest in the space, you had to be agnostic of stage, meaning like early stage, growth stage, late stage companies, right? And you had to be agnostic as to what type of companies. We're all in Bitcoin, so you understand that there are hardware applications, or there are hardware like components, there are nodes, like physical nodes that you can have, there's mining rigs, and then there's software. And so in the past, like these investment companies had to invest across that. And we felt like the ecosystem had matured to a point that we could be very specific.
And so with EcoDeath, do you have particular aspects that you would or would not invest in? Like mining, is that something, or hardware, do you look at that? Or maybe you could take this opportunity to dive into a little bit about, you know, for any of the startups that are out there, what deals do you actually look for? And also, how do you get your deal flow?
I think that this is from Fund One. So we have two funds. We just announced a first close in Fund Two. From Fund One, we are investing in seed stage companies. So we have two more portfolio companies that we'll have in that fund. So we're actively looking for deals. I think that's really important for like a fund to just express. I think from a standpoint of the entrepreneur being on the other side, like, it's not fun to have some of these conversations. And it's even worse when you find out like the fund that you wanted to have, or that you were having a conversation with, is what we call a zombie fund, meaning the fund exists, but the fund is not deploying capital. So I'm letting all the entrepreneurs out there right now, we are deploying capital from Fund One, and we are deploying capital from Fund Two. So Fund One invests at a seed stage. It invests in technology companies building on top of Bitcoin. Half of the fund is reserved for follow-on investments. We see it's pretty key to continue to support your portfolio companies that are winning. That doesn't mean that all companies that we invest in will receive follow-on investments, or that they'll even be the size. You want to overweight the portfolio to your winners. And then from Fund Two, we're looking to lead Series A rounds. So I'm raising a $100 million vehicle. We had a first close that was announced at 43.5, which is great pace. We're really happy with that. The market's awesome. And your question on hardware. So we want these to really be like software companies. Now, if there is a component where like hardware could be the distribution point for the software, I would say the bar is very, very high. Like, we have not invested in any of those to date, but it could happen. It would just have to be a very, very compelling case. We have not invested and would not invest in like a mining company. We see there's a number of, to us, that's more of like a private equity business. It comes down to operational efficiency. It comes out to cost of capital and access to certain resources and how you can utilize those to have your business win. And so that's really kind of like outside the breadth of what a VC fund should be investing in. And so we haven't invested in those, as we wouldn't invest in any mining units. Yeah, happy to answer any other questions.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit maybe what size checks or deals you're looking for at both the seed stage and then when someone kind of graduates to either follow-on capital in that same seed stage or the A that you're looking at? And I guess on the A companies, will those generally come out of your portfolio from Fund One, or are you looking outside of your fund to other companies that you may have missed having the opportunity to invest in early on?
So it can be both. So we've invested in some really amazing companies and they're performing very, very strongly in the first fund. So obviously those that are reaching the Series A stage are kind of key potential investments for the second fund. But there are also, you know, companies that maybe they just grow really quickly and we didn't invest in at the seed stage that we're very open to. So we're really looking quite broadly. And we're certainly looking at companies both inside and outside as the first fund right now.
I would say from like a state, size component. So like just a little bit of market intelligence. So what we're seeing right now is that a seed stage, and I'm going to preface this with like, if any deal has a token in it. So there has been a number of companies that come into the Bitcoin space as of recently that have token components. We don't look at those deals. We actually have token blockers in all of our deals.
I would say we look at them, but like there has to be a reason to have the token. And so what we see is that we haven't found a deal where there's a token where it is actually a requirement, like where it actually is required for the technology to function. So the tokens are acting effectively as early liquidity for the investors and the companies. And that's where we don't really think it makes sense. But if there's a token that actually, for whatever reason, from a technological reason, actually makes sense, or it's down the line in 5-7 years time, once that company is mature, and it's more like an IPO, that could make sense. But just to clarify on what Nico said.
But throwing out those companies, because the VCs in like an early stage company that has a token component are valuation insensitive because of the early liquidity. So the seed stage funds where you're raising based on pure equity or seed stage investments, you're seeing like a $1 to $4 million round size right now. There are not all the funds that are in the space right now are writing checks. So it does take a bit of some Bitcoin funds and some probably funds outside of the space to get those bigger round sizes done. Us as like a lead investor into those rounds are writing about a $1 to $1.5 million check. We average at around a one on the lower end of that. And that gets it done, which is pretty typical. Like it is totally fine to have the lead comprise like 33% of the round. At a Series A, what we've actually seen within the broader market and why we raised the fund was that there's been a huge compression in Series A. No one's writing Series A checks. And it doesn't mean that there are not businesses that are ready for like Series A investments. It just means that there's been a huge amount of people that are scared of writing that check. And the growth stage investors are still there. That value compression like really caused us to go out and raise the Series A fund. You have to be able to, though, like help those companies scale, and you really have to have assembled the team. So that was crucial to bring on Preston, Pish, and Lynn Alden for as we're scaling the company. Those checks also, again, let's take out the companies that have token components at a Series A level. And we haven't written one of these yet, but I imagine that those rounds are getting done, call it between $8 and $16 to $20 million. To be determined. That means that as a lead coming into that, you want to think that at a Series A level, you're probably taking down a third to a half the round.
Nico, I just want to dive into the token question for a little bit, because I do think, and we had this conversation a little bit with Jeff, but I think it's so important to talk about what VC was traditionally, how it kind of changed in recent years with tokenization of companies, and why that's not desirable in your fund and in kind of pure VC, the exit liquidity that Andy mentioned. But can you just dive a little deeper into your philosophy about why tokenization is not optimal for an early stage company? Because I do see a lot of startups being told that's what they need to do by traditional VCs in order to be successful in kind of this, I hate to use the word Web3 space, but the space in which Bitcoin, companies are categorized.
Leave like that component of like why we don't want a company to do it at an early stage to Andy. And I think it's good to preface this as to like, what is venture capital? So venture capital comes from like the origination of like, it was originally ad venture capital, and the ad got dropped and we had venture capital. But venture capital was supposed to fund your like moonshot projects. And venture capital is all based on this power law. So meaning 1 in 10, 1 in 11 of your investments are going to take you to the moon. We're looking to fund like putting an astronaut on the moon. We're looking to fund like space technology. You're looking to push humanity forward. And something's been fundamentally broken, I think, over the past like 7 years, where the way that VC funds are being allocated in the air quotes crypto space is to projects for early liquidity. Like, that is not moving humanity forward. That is not a high risk investment. That is simply making exit liquidity of like retail investors of a project that's more concerned with like marketing itself than it is like actually growing real equity. And I think that that's like really important as like founders to understand. And it's really important for us as like capital allocators to understand, like, you're going to wear this hat. Like, this is what the hat means. We can go into all reasons why like having a token pretty early on in a company provides more, call it, risk to the company's long-term viability and to whatever you're building, the protocol itself. I'll tell you who it doesn't provide risk to. It doesn't provide risk to the investors as they're getting the early liquidity, and to the founders that potentially can sell that at the time period. But I'll let Andy take it from here.
No, I would just add that, you know, venture used to be, it's a very stage-based model. So you invest very early in a company. The company proves itself a little bit. They're able to raise the next round. They're able to kind of scale, then they can raise the next round. But like, as an investor, you're not getting any returns on your investment. You don't get any liquidity on your investment. It's all sort of paper gains as the company grows and raises more capital. And you only get it once the company is like a really successful company. And that typically is like a 7 to 10 year process. They have, you know, $100 million in revenue. They're a big company. They're DoorDash. They're, you know, Reddit just IPO'd now. And what's happened in crypto is now these companies are listing a token and they've existed for 6 months. They don't have any real users and they call it a governance token. Okay. But let's like, we have to understand that's effectively like not true. It's effectively, you don't need a token for governance. You don't need a token for the technology to work. The only reason for these tokens is basically to get early liquidity. And that means that at 6 months old, this company has maybe not even any users, no revenue, nothing whatsoever. And they're listing a token, but they're able to, because of the hype, effectively the investors and the founders of that company get returns on their investment, you know, in the next 6, 12, 18 months. And then, but what happens, right? Like, now the investors have their returns. The founders have all this money. Like, why would they even bother to continue to build that company? And not only that, you have this external attack vector. So as a baby little company, it's really hard. You know, like, things are going to go wrong. You're going to lose customers. Like, you're going to have a regulatory issue. Like, you're not going to get the growth you wanted. And there's a reason why a 6-month-old company, a little baby company, doesn't have a publicly traded stock for it, because it would be so volatile. So what happens in a highly, highly hyped, highly volatile environment like crypto, if you have a traded token, you might see your token go down 98% over the course of a year. And so even if you did have a real product and you did have a good customer, if your token has gone down 98%, imagine trying to sell your product to a new customer. That customer is going to say, why would I want to work with you? Your stock or your token is down 98%. That doesn't make any sense. And this is what we've seen play out time and time again in the sort of Ethereum and other ecosystems, such that it's actually hindered anything actually getting built in those ecosystems. And unfortunately, now we're seeing it on Bitcoin. While it's sort of like a drug in a way, you know, the market is become a little bit addicted to it, but it's not actually conducive to long-term health, long-term wellness, long-term viability. It's not creating anything of value. It's just this sort of like drug in a hyped kind of like fueled up market that people are able to make money off in the short term. And so as a fund, like, we want to really invest in companies, like Nico said, that are really building products or real people and in some way that are contributing to the world. And while there could be a company that raises a token and does very, very well, we just think that the risks around that are so great that unless there's a really valid reason to have that token, we're very, very, very hesitant to invest.
Thanks for getting into the details of the logic behind all of that. I mean, it's something that Lynn and I from the beginning, before starting build this podcast of Build with Bitcoin, we're already speaking to. And to your point, Andy, you know, as far as long-term health and long-term real value, it's at least becoming very clear to us. I mean, because we keep having on many different guests, both on the investor and the entrepreneurial side, that have that precise mindset going into this, right? And you kind of need to, if you're going for a long-term profitable business, you can't be, it seems like just a very obvious misallocation of capital, which at the same time creates massive opportunity for those that are kind of laser focused on, you know, all the real value being created on the Bitcoin protocol. To that point, I mean, are you seeing some maybe more traditional players or maybe other traditional VC funds approaching you guys? I mean, interested in learning, perhaps now that you're, you know, focusing at a slightly more, you know, quote unquote, de-risked stage at Series A?
I would say we're still in the early stages. That said, there are some very, very sharp traditional VCs. They're not the ones that you would see, like if you think crypto VC, they're not the ones that you think when you think crypto VC, but there are some very, very sharp traditional venture funds looking at the space pretty seriously, and particularly sort of in the Series B stages and beyond.
The other thing that I would say about that from like an institutional standpoint, I think Andy's spot on. And like as these institutions get bigger, though, you generally have like one champion inside of it. So you'll have like, that's the Bitcoin guy, and they have $105 billion fund of funds, or that's the Bitcoin guy, and we advise $40 billion of where to place money. The problem that plays in with these organizations is that when you think about like the size of those organizations and what those individuals are paid and how they're set up, there's not that asymmetric opportunity for them to like put their neck out on the line as much as like in VC, we say we can only lose as much as we invest. But if we miss out on like 1,000x return, like that's a big problem. That is a really big problem. And we better have a good justification as to why we didn't do that. But in these other massive organizations, and they can be investment funds, they can be publicly traded companies, pretty much there's no upside for that individual. There's like, okay, this could be good. And if it goes well, it would be good for the organization. But as far as their job security, which is what they care about, it's only going to play in if it goes wrong. And the chance of it going wrong is high. Like this is a venture capital fund. It's a high risk vehicle. We have to be right about the industry. We have to be right about the timing. We think we're very, very thorough as far as capital allocators, but we can also understand like the motivating factors behind those other people. That said, like Andy said, we are having the conversations with just about every single fund that you could think about and major institutions. Right now, a lot of the powder in the space, though, comes from family offices, as it's much easier to get you and five of your family members that have a bit of powder on the same page and have high conviction over this space and then are time insensitive to the rate of return.
Yeah, that was, you were leading right into my next question, which is LPs. What is kind of the profile of the LP? I mean, I just see so much money going into the crypto space and traditional VC. I almost think that so much money went into traditional VC that it kind of motivated the whole move to tokenization to try and take some money off the table in early stage, you know, when there were the ICOs and the different models that could allow that exit liquidity to happen. But, you know, when you're looking at you raising this fund, the fund that you're raising right now, the $100 million fund, of which 43.5 is closed, you know, who are you talking to, or what types of people? I mean, is the ETF and the kind of the mainstream conversation that Bitcoin is now entering in, is that making it easier for you to have conversations with institutional investors, or is it still pretty much high net worth individuals and family offices?
I think most of our investors are ultra high net worth family offices. A lot of them are entrepreneurial, you know, people who have built a very successful business. Maybe they have a family business. And then some also institutions. I would say at the institutional level, a lot of big institutions have invested directly in Bitcoin. You know, a lot of them would have had an allocation to crypto. I think a lot of them have had somewhat negative experiences with the crypto allocations. And so there's a big there's some sort of scar tissue there around that. And so there's a re-evaluation happening internally around their allocations. And then per Nico's point, you have this need for people first to get Bitcoin and then to sort of understand that there's things that can be built on top of it. and what that ecosystem looks like, and really understanding that is sort of then another hurdle as well. So I would say, you know, from an institutional perspective, I would say they're slower, and they will probably come later. And also they typically write bigger checks. So for them, for it to be meaningful, they would prefer to actually write larger checks. And so for now, you know, the family office is really, we think, our sweet spot. But that said, we do have several institutions involved in the fund already and having conversations with more.
I would say one other thing too on that is, like, we added to the advisor roster in like fund two. So we brought on Pete Brigger as an advisor. He is an investor in fund one. He's been public about that and is fine with us saying that. Pete Brigger, for any of the audience that don't know, is the chairman of Fortress. I think they have north of 40 billion under management. He's a highly sophisticated investor. He is in the circle and the rooms of the decision makers in traditional finance and policy. He's a Council on Foreign Relations member. So this is like the industry is moving here, and that people, he was also like a very early believer in Bitcoin, but the industry is moving here. And I think like those type of people, from a brand perspective, like Pete has a lot at risk, right? And especially even being an advisor of a fund of our size. But that gives confidence and allows us, I think, a little bit easier probably with the conversation, as a lot of it is just like you being able to listen or being like at the right stage for us to be open to like hearing about the investment opportunity.
We were kind of speaking to this offline a little earlier, right? It's definitely entering into, I think, the next stage of maturity with ETF, the institutionals, the acceptance of the industry in a way. You know, you have a lot more of the political side now also kind of coming on board. Are there still any specific risks that your investors are pointing to at this stage? I mean, or is it are they just kind of trying to get a grasp of the timeline of how long this is going to take to play out?
I think there's always regulatory risks. Like with any of these companies, it's probably the biggest thing. Like we have our investment thesis allows us to invest around the world because Bitcoin companies can cater to a customer base that's around the world. But there are inherent regulatory risks that we have seen pop up with U.S. regulations, with MiCA in Europe. These are things that companies have to be cognizant of. They have to navigate them properly. You could have a company that's in compliance today and then is out of compliance tomorrow, or they are out of compliance because a new law has just come in and the business has really glaring, call it, holes because of that. I think that that's the biggest risk. I think the part of being able to re-domicile companies or move them, companies are not like the companies of the early 2000s where they have big Palo Alto headquarters. These are decentralized entities. They could move pretty quickly. They have Delaware corporate paperwork, but that paperwork could be moved to wherever it needs to be. I think, I mean, that's my opinion, that is the biggest risk today.
Kind of taking the opportunity, do you want to point out any one or two or three of your portfolio companies just to kind of give an example of the type of space that you're investing in and who some of your, you know, your darlings are?
We had one that just came up that I think is like really, really cool. So Save the Children is one of the biggest. I think it's over 100 years old as a non-government organization. Delivers hundreds of billions of dollars of aid to, I think, 3 billion people around the world, potentially. But that's the target of that. I think it's hundreds of millions of people that they actually deliver it to. They just announced a partnership with Fetty. So Fetty is one of our portfolio companies from Fund One. And they're using Fetty's Fediment protocol, which is, think of it as like collaborative custody. And they're allowing it basically aid to be dispersed directly. So if we think of it in the past, if you looked at how aid was dispersed, the loops of, or the hoops that it would go through going through the nonprofit to anything else, any other kind of like bumps it would hit along the way, you would get a large chunk of that taken out before it was actually dispersed to the individuals on the ground. And so this massive NGO, Save the Children, is doing a pilot with Fetty. I think it is in the Philippines. I think it's the Philippines. It's quite profound. And like, it's using Bitcoin. It has the potential to expand broadly because of that. I think it's pretty exciting.
We did talk with Obi, so we have an episode that talks about FETI, but I love that idea because you also think about even aid that's needed on an immediate basis in case of a natural disaster. And if that happens, we saw it with the Ukraine war when it first broke out. But if it's Sunday morning and you need supplies or something, you know, you can move that on Bitcoin, but you can't in the banking system. So yeah, we're fans of FETI also.
As far as, you know, maybe geographical dispersion of the founders and startups that you're, you know, having conversations with or have already invested in, Andy and Nico, are there any particular trends worth highlighting? I mean, I would imagine a bulk of that is the US, but, you know, maybe if you can give us an idea of where you're seeing these startups, you know, geographically based out of.
I actually think there's a lot happening in Europe. I would say Europe is, I think the number is the highest we have in the US, but even of that, you know, Obi spends a lot of time in Portugal. We're seeing some really, really strong founders and ideas coming through Europe right now, actually. I think the nice thing about Europe is even though they have this pretty strict framework of MiCA, they have regulatory clarity in Europe. So that just makes it much easier if you're trying to build something. And I would say, you know, countries like France over the last 5 to 10 years have really invested and just been incredibly successful at shifting the entire culture to really support entrepreneurship. And so we're seeing out of France, you know, Switzerland, Germany, different places, really, really kind of exciting entrepreneurs. And LATAM as well.
What about any kinds of trends in technology that are exciting to you as Bitcoin and the layer twos are evolving? Are there things that you're seeing in the future that you get excited about funding or looking for?
I don't think there's anything specific. We have kind of a roadmap of different ideas, like where we see gaps that people could potentially build a business. I think eCash is really interesting. Obviously, we have FETI and Cashew are the two product, or the two, I guess. I mean, Cashew is more open source projects. FETI is a company, but I think eCash as an innovation is really interesting. I think there's a lot to be done in custody. Custody in general still isn't solved. I think Unchained went on an investor in Unchained. I think that you know, really making a lot of positive progress towards making it much easier, safer for people to do custody, as is FETI. So I think that's two options. And then the other thing is, it's just like not that easy still in most parts of the world to buy Bitcoin. I think we overestimate. Like, that's a problem that isn't yet solved. We have two companies in our portfolio where basically they just help people buy Bitcoin in a really seamless, easy, simple way. And still that's a problem that's not solved. So we're seeing in different parts of the world that's happening. But then from there, I think we're always surprised by the types of innovations that come out. It's I think that's what's exciting, actually, about what we do. Nico, do you have things you're excited about?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we think about is like not wanting to prime the entrepreneur's brain. So like why we have like themes, we're investors, like we're entrepreneurs in the fund and have been entrepreneurs in the past, but it's really up to the entrepreneur you want a product driven entrepreneur who finds a problem that they have uniquely experienced, they're uniquely qualified to solve it. And then one of the other things I think to help out these entrepreneurs and is thinking through timing. So while you might be right on what you're trying to go after and longer term, it may work. The timing is really, really key from like our perspective. So just to give the audience a little bit of information. So a VC fund has a 10-year fund life, meaning that by time the end of the fund hits, and you can extend it a little bit, but you don't want to extend it for more than probably 2 to 3 years, there needs to be some type of liquidity event. And so if some of these things are too far out from a timing perspective, it might be best for us from a fund to wait until we have a future fund and we can give the company the right amount of time for the market to come and mature, I think is a really, really key thing and something for entrepreneurs to think about as they're evaluating funds of where is that fund at in its fund life cycle. If you have a really, really large investor and they are at the end of their investment period, so typically what you see with venture capital funds is a 3 to 5 year investment period, depending on the fund. So if they're at the back of that investment period and you're still pretty early on in the life cycle of your company and that investor has a lot of your company, they're probably going to push you for liquidity earlier on. And so it's just like one of these things we always say, like what we are evaluating, but the company should be doing the exact same thing in evaluating the people that are providing it capital.
And then maybe just to get into a bit more of that process, Nico, can you or Andy give us an idea of the due diligence process itself? I mean, what to expect as a startup founder if someone does approach Ego Death, whether it's the seed or Series A stage?
Yeah, I think just expect like a lot of questions and sometimes the process might be annoying if you're an investor, if you're a founder, but I mean, if we think about like what we're in, the amount of money we're investing in some of these companies versus what they actually have, like it's a really high valuation. And so we're putting a lot of our capital on the line. We've raised money from those investors. We take every dollar that we put into a company very, very seriously. And so I think just we have to be really diligent about companies we invest in. We have to really know what we're doing. So there's going to be a lot of questions about the tech, about the founders, about the market size. And also expect that the investor will disagree with you on things. The investor might have feedback. We might say, hey, we don't like this. Like, can we think about changing it? That doesn't mean you have to change it. But I think often it's worth realizing that VC companies have the ability to see so many companies and how they operate. Whereas often if you're inside one company, you might not have that same pattern recognition. You might not have seen 10 companies or 50 or 100 companies, you know, go from C to Series A, go from zero to one. And so being sort of open to that feedback as well, I think is really important and something we look for in founders. We're not saying we're always right. Definitely not. At the end of the day, you know, a founder typically knows their business better than anyone else can. But being open to feedback is something we really, really look for. In terms of the diligence process and timing, it really depends. You know, we can move really, really fast if we want to, and if we need to. It can also take longer, and we typically, you know, we're not going to just dive in and sign documents. Because of the amount of capital and time and resources we're putting into every company, we do want to do things properly as well, and so that can be maybe a little different to some funds, but it can be. Yeah, but it's hard to say how long the process would take.
And when you're evaluating, how much does the team or the individual founder matter to you or prioritize over the idea or the actual technology that's being utilized? I mean, how do you weigh the different factors that they're presenting to you?
The pre-seed stage, the founder is literally everything. Like, you know, all of us have great ideas all the time, and they're worth, you know, zero until they're actually executed on. Once you get to, say, a seed stage, if the company's starting to make money, you might see a bit of a shift. But at the end of the day, it's really about execution. All of this is about, like, can the founder execute? Do we think the founder has what it takes to execute on this idea? Once you get to the Series A stage, I would say the business has effectively achieved product market fit. There is a real business there. And so you want to know that the right team is in place, but you're not solely investing at that point based on the founder. But at the end of the day, that's the CEO, that's the team that's there. Like, if you don't think that they can execute, you're not going to invest. And so it's really like early stage investing is so much about the team. And that's not to say we're just looking at the team. What we're looking at is what they've built. So if you've gotten a company from zero to several million dollars in revenue, like that's extraordinary proof that you have what it takes to actually like do what you need going forward as well. And maybe there's some gaps. Like every founder has strengths and weaknesses. Every founding team, every company has strengths and weaknesses. So we'll say, okay, this is the things that maybe they're doing really well. These are the things that we need, you know, we can potentially work with them on. So even though you might be saying it's all about the founder, but the business is evidence that the founder has what it takes once you get to kind of later stage.
We appreciate getting into the details of how the actual process works, because sometimes as a founder or new startup to the venture capital investing process, things can be a bit confusing and things can seem a bit like a black box. Lynn, anything you want to add or that we we should still highlight?
Yeah, one thing, Nika, you'd brought up two other partners in the fund. I know that you, Andy, and Jeff started Ego Death, but I know that they were advisors before, but I think that they're now general partners in this current fund. But Preston Pish and Lynn Alden, how do you guys segregate the responsibilities amongst yourself, or can you talk a little bit about bringing them onto the fund and how you see the fund operating in terms of your internal metrics and perspectives?
I think this is a really interesting thing that you ask. And like, we are still a really small team. So like, if there's like wood that has to be chopped, you're going to chop it. If there's water that's going to have to be carried, you're going to carry it. I saw this quote, this video with Jim Simmons the other day. So the founder of Renaissance Technology, he just passed away this past year. I think it's aligned with like his thinking of, if you put really smart people in a room together, like magic happens, and you just allow them to like interact and talk, and you give them access to resources, we're able to do pretty special things. And I think that there's always the point with a team forming where you have this stage of like the forming, storming, like norming and performing, I think was the thing. It's been a while since I've been in college, but I think that was the point of like, you're going to be like, am I stepping on that person's toes? Is this mine or is this theirs? But you get a good, I would say, sense of the other people. I think the other point with like Jim Simmons, which is really, really important, I think that we did this without even realizing it. So Andy, Jeff, myself, you want those people to be equity holders, like partners. You want to bring them up into an organization where they own something and they are invested in that organization, like growing and prospering. You don't want them to be like cogs in a machine that are easily replaced. And so by understanding, like, Preston and Lynn are incredibly impressive individuals, and their time is very valuable. We had to build something first that was like worth their time. But at that point, it was important for us to bring on partners, like partners in a fund, and grow that fund with them. I feel very, very lucky to get to work with my four other partners in the fund. And I would say, like, doesn't matter who it is, like, if the floor needs to be mopped, the floor is getting mopped, and someone's going to like run to grab that mop.
And I guess the only other question that we'll leave it with is, you haven't closed on the full 100 million. So are there opportunities for investors to get involved with Ego Death, and, you know, maybe some tactical how to reach you in terms of either founders that have a company that they want to present to you, or investors that want to get in touch with you and learn a little bit more about how to get involved with you? How would you direct them?
It's a great question, and thank you for allowing us to like plug ourselves at the end of your podcast. We are still raising the fund. You can reach us at contact@egodeath.capital for both if you're interested in investing in the fund, or you're an entrepreneur that's looking for investment. If that's too much to remember, you could just go to our website and contact us through the website, and it'll very quickly direct you to if you're an investor or if you're looking for funding. We're open to conversations with anybody. So while we might have like, at the beginning, I know we came on a little bit hard on the token component or whatever else, like, while we might not invest in it, we're happy to have the conversation with anybody. At the end of the day, we're all people.
Well, I mean, this conversation's been very, very useful. So we thank both of you for your time. We know you're busy people as well. And it's just great to have, you know, such professional and purpose-driven investors like yourselves in the space. To your point earlier, Andy, there's still, you know, many problems to be solved. Sometimes if you've been in the space for a while, you maybe forget, you know, how difficult it can be to understand what Bitcoin is, the technology behind it. It can still be hard to use. So there's still so many opportunities. And a few years ago, there really wasn't many strategic partners or investors like yourselves to count on if you wanted to build and scale a business, right? So, it's amazing for Lynn and I to get to know a few of the players out there, but specifically to what you guys are doing. You've been some of the lead investors in this Bitcoin only VC space, and you know, we appreciate the time as well.
We have found when Israel and I were doing the kind of the research about who to talk to, there's a surprisingly interesting and varied array of companies that are building with Bitcoin in different aspects. And Andy, I know that you've done a lot of work on Noster, and we're really interested in that technology too, anything that's really distributed or freedom oriented. But the investor universe is small. And so we hope to bring you back on again periodically and just kind of check in with you, what you're seeing in terms of trends, what the investment environment is. I mean, we're hoping that we're kind of at a tipping point where we will start seeing more entrepreneurs enter the space and understand the value of building on Bitcoin, to your point, with a more solid and secure foundation than some of the other protocols. And so you're the ones who are on the front line seeing it all the time. And so we really appreciate your time and effort and hope to bring you back on to share your observations with us in the future.
Awesome. No, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us and for the conversation and for your questions. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Build with Bitcoin podcast. If you found benefit in what you heard in this episode, we'd appreciate it if you would like, share, or leave a comment. This helps others find us, which is especially important for this new podcast. And if we had lawyers, they'd tell us to tell you that the content of this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only and is not to be considered investment advice or a recommendation to invest in any company or asset mentioned in the episode. Thank you sincerely for being a part of the Build with Bitcoin community.